I'm James Myers, host of Playlist Pod. I'm glad to be back after a much-needed break of a few months, following four seasons with 66 episodes in which participants provided some incredible insights on the works of Plato, the philosopher and geometer who wrote nearly 2,400 years ago. For the first episode of our fifth season, I was pleased to welcome in discussion Michael Fitzpatrick. In our fourth season, Michael was instrumental and inspirational in contributing to and leading episodes on Plato's final work, The Laws. Our goal for today's discussion was to bring Plato into the 21st century by applying principles from a number of his dialogues to current political and social issues around the globe. We don't take partisan positions, nor do we mention names in our dialogue, which was wide-ranging and touched on many present-day circumstances that were also concerns in Plato's time in terms of political leadership and social cohesion. Michael is a Plato scholar, a university instructor, and a doctoral candidate in philosophy at Stanford University. He's taught university courses in both philosophy and literature at a number of institutions, and also studies philosophers in Europe from 1600 to 1800, as well as contemporary Platonists such as Alfred North Whitehead and Alain Badiou. I invite listeners to reflect on and respond to the topics that we discuss. We'd love to know what you think, and welcome your suggestions for future discussion topics. Please email your thoughts and comments to dialoguesonplato@outlook.com. And if you'd like to join the future discussions, please let me know. As listeners to the group discussions of the first four seasons of Plato's Pod will understand, Plato didn't provide conclusions, but instead encouraged the application of reason and dialogue to find paths to the universal principles of truth, goodness, and beauty. This has always been, and always will be, the goal of Plato's Pod, and we're so glad that you've chosen to join in our dialogue. Well, Michael, welcome to season five of Plato's Pod. I thought it would be really interesting, given what we discussed in our sessions on Plato's Laws, to reflect on Plato as his ideas might apply in the current circumstances in the 21st century. And you've started a blog, Plato for the Masses, and you've expressed some pretty strident opinions, maybe, about the current situation. And I think its situation has kind of, across the world, I think generally we're seeing a lot of polarization in societies. And this is being expressed, I think, at the ballot box across the world throughout this year. I mean, I think half the planet went to the ballot box this year. And it's time that we reflect maybe on the philosophy of what's going on behind this democratic process. And, you know, is it in fact a democratic process? How would Plato have seen this process in the context of democracy as it existed then, but, you know, also in the ideals of democracy? And so I thought it'd be really interesting to bring Plato into the 21st century in this sense and just see if we can apply some of his thinking to the way things are unfolding now. Maybe we can find some parallels to what he said then. So welcome. Looking forward to the discussion.
Absolutely. Thanks, James. And for people who find this conversation interesting, you can find more of my work at Plato for the Masses on Substack.
Well, that's great. And certainly you bring some good history of political philosophy, I think, into that as well. So that's interesting for some background to some more current background, I guess, in the current situation. So I know the consequences of some of these elections have been quite disturbing to some and disturbing to yourself, as you've expressed in your blog. So now we have this polarization. We have civilizations or societies that just, you know, people can't speak to each other anymore. There's just incredible divide where people are separating into two camps. And I think some people even think that there's, in fact, I've heard the statement saying that it's kind of an effective civil war going on in some of these societies. What might Plato's characters have prescribed if we could bring his characters into the 21st century? Given the constitutions that we have now, obviously, they're not the ideal constitutions. I think we're seeing the problems with them. If they were to look at the situation now and the constitutions that we have, and with a view to maybe bringing back some harmony or bringing some harmony to the situation, I'm just wondering, what would they say? Any of the characters, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, there are two sort of foundational Platonic thoughts that I think are relevant for today. The first is, democracies have always styled themselves as being spaces of deliberation. In fact, in the United States, we sometimes call the United States Senate the greatest deliberative body on earth. But at least in recent decades, there has been very little deliberation actually taking place. And I think that would be the first thing that Plato or his characters would highlight is the nature of real conversation, a real back and forth exchange of reasons, has the power to liberate a society. But if you only practice the impression of that, what Plato has many of his characters call disputation, then you fall into this game of trying to win arguments or win power for your side rather than actually having a conversation for the sake of a higher ideal. And of course, for Plato, those higher ideals would be things like truth or justice. So I think they would challenge democracies to look in the mirror and say, you talk a lot about the importance of deliberation, but are you actually being deliberative? Are you having real dialogues, or are you just having an argument for the sake of winning?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, people just can't seem to find any sort of common ground now, especially when there are large political movements sort of pitted against each other. It becomes kind of a battle for power as opposed to a battle for ideals or even a discussion. I mean, I guess whether it's the media or how. If a discussion were to start, I mean, how would it propagate? I mean, do we have kind of the infrastructure for a real discussion to propagate in a way that doesn't pit people against each other, that people would actually take a moment to think about things and listen to reason? Or is it just, are we stuck in a situation where it's just the powerful voices, the people that have the most, compelling appearance on camera? How would we get reason to happen? I mean, it's something that just seems to be gone. I mean, the common sense, where is it?
Well, I want to note that what you're describing is not something Plato was unfamiliar with. I mean, he lived in a day where the popular tragedians, the sophists, the successful military commanders, they were the ones who dominated the public square. So he was very familiar with this idea that a few voices seem to control the narrative. And I think your question, let me circle back to it by offering the second foundational thing I was thinking of on your first question, which is we're not going to have dialogue if we don't recognize that dialogue will only be a competition of interests unless it's oriented towards something that transcends ourselves. So again, for Plato, that was truth, goodness, beauty, and justice, that these are transcendent ideals that are beyond any particular social, political, economic situation humans find themselves at a particular moment of time. And so dialogue becomes possible when we're oriented towards those higher ideals, I think. And it devolves into this fractious, polarized, combative space when we lose sight of those ideals. And instead, all we're focusing on is getting our share of the pie. And of course, Plato diagnosed this as the problem of might makes right, such that whoever is most popular or whoever has the most money, or whoever has the biggest army, or in the case of electoral democracy, whoever can get the most votes, they get to set the agenda. And the idea of this higher ideal sort of fades away. And so there's a lot more to say to your question, and I think we will as we continue this conversation. But I think the first thing to is it possible to have reasoned conversation today? I want to say yes, only if we return our focus to some of those transcendental ideals.
Yeah, higher ideal is a it's something that seems to be lost in a lot of the discourse now. And I don't know whether that's a constitutional thing. I know in Canada, the Constitution of Canada was based on so-called peace, order, and good government. That was maybe kind of the constitutional ideal here in the US. I think it's life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. But there's so many problems defining those words, especially happiness, I think. And I'm wondering whether people tend to latch on to these constitutional terms and think that that's all there is. And I know Plato in The Statesman talks about how constitutions can get out of touch with the current times and out of touch with the way people see things. And I'm wondering whether when constitutions were formed, in the US in the 1780s, in Canada 100 years later, whether things have just fundamentally shifted. And maybe there was an assumption back then that it was understood what the ideal of a democratic society was, but maybe it wasn't properly written down or conveyed or written down in a way that it could be adjusted over time. What do you think caused this loss of a higher ideal, if it ever existed?
Yeah, good. So I want to touch on each of the things you brought up because this question of the history of a nation, its history of being founded on ideals and those ideals being preserved, I think is something that's still really poorly understood. So in the United States, the Constitution was written in what we call the Constitutional Convention. And this meant it was a small, deliberative body that really was engaging in deliberation. They were exchanging reasons, they were forming side coalitions, they were drafting different versions of foundational laws and then passing them around, and people were scribbling all over them. It was so fecund and productive. And they envisioned that these kinds of conventions would be convened on a regular basis. They even provided for this in the United States Constitution that although there is a national legislature that can write laws, the states also have the power to convene constitutional conventions whenever necessary to amend the Constitution. Of course, now this gets to your question of did they not foresee certain problems? They were writing the provision of a constitutional convention in the context of 13 small states that had small populations. They were not envisioning the large, sweeping nation states that we have today. Now, I understand Canada has a smaller national population, but in the United States, we're over 350 million and an enormous landmass. And so what has turned out by an accident of history is that getting states to call constitutional conventions turned out to not be something the states were interested in doing as a matter of course. So, someone like me, I would amend the United States Constitution to just mandate regular conventions every 20 years, precisely because you will never have 350 million people have the kind of deliberation that we're talking about. But if you get carefully selected delegates into a room together and let them debate for 3 months, they could do an enormous amount of good work. And we're not creating those types of spaces. So I don't think we need mass deliberation. That's not possible. But we need a convention that returns us to what are our ideals. And are we living up to them? And we need to be refreshing ourselves on this on a regular basis and not just looking back to the founding of our nations as sufficient for doing that.
That's a really interesting idea, actually. And in Canada, we brought our founding constitution was the British North America Act. It wasn't even really a constitution, it was an act of the British Parliament. And that was turned into our constitution in 1982. So we did, I guess, have a bit of a convention at that point. But since then, attitudes have hardened and the vested interests are entrenched, and nobody wants to change anything now, even though there are needs for some changes. But I like that idea of mandating some sort of regular review.
Well, let me read, since you brought up Plato's Statesman, let me read a famous passage that starts at 294b from The Statesman that I think really captures Plato's attitude towards law. And of course, he writes a whole book called Laws, so we know he's not anti-law, but he's not he's very, well, I should say he's very realistic about what law is. So let me just read this, and I'd be curious to see how you think this orients how we should be thinking about our constitutions and so forth. He says, law could never accurately embrace what is best and most just for all at the same time, and so prescribe what is best. For the dissimilarities between human beings and their actions, and the fact that practically nothing in human affairs ever remains stable, prevent any sort of expertise whatsoever from making any simple decision in any sphere that covers all cases and will last for all time. So I see Plato having his characters there sort of describe the limitation of a legal system, which is legal systems are usually produced in a reactive sort of way. Something happened, and then we made a law to deal with that. But then another situation comes, and it's something that the law didn't anticipate. And so I think Plato, while he does have a high regard for the value of law, also envisions a flexible law that is utilized by wise legislatures and wise administrators who can exercise their wisdom where the law falls short. And I think today we're not allowing the law to be nimble. We're not allowing the law to grow and evolve. And worst of all, we're not implementing good, virtuous legislators and administrators who can fill in the gaps between the laws with their wisdom. What do you think about that?
No, I agree. I mean, I think this is what leads to these rigid, inflexible constitutions when people try to go back 2.5 centuries in time and interpret current circumstances against what was written then. We live in a totally different world with, I think particularly of a concern to me is what technology is doing to our ability to have a reasonable discourse. And the laws are just simply not. They weren't written, of course, 200 years ago with any knowledge that this was coming. And so, in terms of how to address the situation, one really can't look back into a constitutional structure that was struck 2.5 centuries ago. So, absolutely. I mean, we need to have some sort of flexibility. And as you say, I mean, that was a great passage because it really does point out that you can't, nobody can perfectly define all of the situations for all time to come. So any originalist who wants to go back and interpret today's situations with what was written 2.5 centuries ago, there's always going to be problems. As you say, I mean, nothing is stable. So the laws can't prescribe. And I think understanding the limitations of the legal system is an important thing. You said that. I think we need to understand that there has to be, I think, a point where we have to engage in some sort of discourse. We can't just simply look to the written word and say, that's all there is. We need to have that discussion. And I think that's, unfortunately, that's the problem. I think with the vested interest now, there are certain vested interests that will want to stick to the ancient wording because it serves them. And then it becomes a big debate. I mean, I know in Canada, for example, when the current government was first elected, they were talking about changing the voting. I think it was going to be instead of first past the post in each constituency, it was going to be representation by population. And the members of parliament were sent out to get the opinions of their constituents. And it worked for a while, but then the whole thing collapsed because of the vested interest. And nobody wanted to change the existing system because some people would lose things and it became too contentious and it just got dropped. I guess in theory, yes, we can have these discussions, but practically speaking, in a technological society where, with the press of a button, you can get your opinion out to 300 million people and distort things if you want, or be nice if you want. I guess, practically speaking, what's going to enforce some sort of civility in these discussions and reason, that common sense? we sometimes, I guess, defer to leaders who, as I was saying in the introduction, just kind of have that presence and, they say they know what they're talking about. And so we tend to believe them, whereas maybe we should be exercising our own faculty of reason. So I don't know. I mean, how do we take this kind of instantaneous reaction mode that we have in the world now? I mean, if we brought Socrates into the 21st century and we told him about how the internet works and how with a tweet one can get one's opinions around the world, what would he say? I mean, yeah, great, have a reasonable discourse, sit in the grove and have a nice discussion, but that's just not going to happen today, right?
Well, I think your questions are before we can really assess the way that mass media has fundamentally changed the way we relate to each other, we have to recognize that this requires us to confront the meaning of the word that has been thrown around a lot in recent decades, which is democracy. So, in my country, we just had a lot of discussions about how democracy was on the ballot. And what was really frustrating for me, and the reason why I've started writing a long series of essays on both politics and political philosophy, is because at no point did we have a conversation about what democracy really means. And this is something that I think Plato and his peers were really good at, is the whole Platonic model in each dialogue is to sort of pick an idea and then inquire as to what its true meaning is. And so I think a Socrates today would expect us to stop and say, wait, what is this thing you're calling democracy? If you're saying democracy is on the ballot, what is it? Just like Euthyphro is going to go and impose impiety as an accusation on his father, Socrates says, no, wait, before you go in the courtroom, what is this thing that you're so confident you know? And I think for most ordinary citizens, democracy is what they really mean by it is something like not what is happening in, and then pick your favorite totalitarian country. And so they define in their heads democracy in this very negative way. Well, it's not that thing over there. And I think the United States bears a lot of blame for this because in the 1950s, we had a lot of rhetoric defining democracy as not Stalinist communism. And so we set kind of a template for the whole world of, there's these two forces and they're battling it out. Maybe that was appropriate for its time, I'm not sure. But today, I think it is time for a serious reckoning as to what is democracy really, because I don't think most of us really have a clear idea. And I think what some people would define democracy as is something not worth keeping. And that's going to be a hard conversation to have.
Yeah, agreed. And I think what emerged after World War II with that sharp divide between the democracies and the communist countries, primarily the Soviet Union, I guess, and China too, that was maybe kind of followed out of World War II. After that huge battle against a totalitarian, tyrannical regime, and then here was this next enemy was there. But at the meantime, there was great progress being made in terms of resolving some of the social differences. I mean, racial divisions, barriers started to come down. People started to, I think, over some years, maybe until the mid-90s, I think that project where the European Union came together, I mean, that was kind of extraordinary that those countries with such diverse, long entrenched histories of differences could come together and form that union. But now it's suffering as well. And I don't know. I just really think that it's this lack of discourse that has been technologically fueled. And I think that really started in the mid-90s when, and maybe even early 2000s, I guess, with the social media advent, where people stopped having a conversation and seeing each other's eyes and understanding their meaning from the body language. And And then they started just making these anonymous comments where they didn't see the effect of what they were saying. I had a chance to look at what Plato wrote about democracy and the Republic. You mentioned at the outset this idea of might makes right. That's the kind of Thrasymachus view at the beginning of the Republic. When he asked what justice is, Thrasymachus says it's whatever the mighty say it is, essentially. And I think maybe we're coming down to that again, in a sense that, as you say, I mean, do people really know what it means? So one of Plato's dialogues, it really surprised me. I really couldn't connect with it, but it really surprised me when I understood it was a Cratylus and understanding the meaning of words. And so if we talk about democracy, the two roots of the word, demos and kratia, I think, power of the people. But what does power mean? And is going to the ballot box, is that simply the exercise of power? You're right. I mean, we need to have that conversation. What is democracy? What is power of the people? What should that look like? Now, I'm thinking of our sessions on the laws. There was a really interesting thing in the laws where the guardians of the laws were the top people empowered with ensuring the constitutional framework, I guess, was maintained stable. They weren't given the executive authority over government. Different people were elected for that purpose, but the guardians of the laws were there. But it was really is it the power of the people in the laws who selected the guardians. I really like that structure where anybody could nominate somebody for a guardian, anybody could remove a nomination, and they had to go through that process many times to finally sift through all of these candidates to find truly the best ones. Where, of course, back then they weren't making TV appearances and having social media influencers and all of this. But to me, that was a real power of the people where everybody was expected to make a nomination, at least make a nomination, not just show up at the voting booth, but actually to think about who would be a good person. I don't know, is that something that we could bring somehow into the 21st century?
Well, let's really break down some of the ideas that you're thinking about here. So I think the first question you're raising is, what types of leaders are we actually trying to put in power? And I think a fundamental flaw with democracies in the 21st century as they're practiced today is the tacit assumption in nearly all of them that the people should get whatever, quote unquote, they want. And that would not have made sense to Plato or his characters. So, in the laws, the Athenian stranger is stressing that the goal is to find the best and most competent and most virtuous people of the society and to put them in these roles. So, at no point, even when Plato is articulating different forms of elections, is the idea that the person who gets selected is what the people want. Because the people's desires are fickle, they're ill-formed, and most importantly, they're highly manipulable. This is part of the lesson of Plato's famous allegory of the cave, is that most people are subject to puppet masters who are presenting images of what they want them to see. And I sort of think the idea of the cave with the fire throwing shadows on the wall, that really is the original social media in many ways. Or it's this vision of people living in a reality that has been manufactured for them. And that's what Twitter and Facebook, and as well as cable networks, that's what they do is they manufacture a reality. They manufacture narratives. They manufacture sides and interests and stakes, and then they get people to get outraged over different things. And that is not at all what Plato is describing in any of his political works. He's describing people who are employing systems whose only justification is that they are systems that reliably find the best people in society and put them in positions of power. Now, both are systems that say they're power of the people. But I think Plato's vision is of a people who are empowered and who are actively participating in the polis, Whereas our modern democracies are mostly people disempowered. They have no political voice except once every 2 or 4 years when they get to cast a ballot. And that ballot is filled with manufactured choices. And then, that's it. They have to wait another 2 years in most cases. And so that's a very disempowering vision. So I don't think democracy can be simply the people have power, because I think in Plato's vision, the people are not being manipulated by these special interests. Whereas in our contemporary day, I think the masses are being highly manipulated. And so the electoral outcomes are more reflective of how they've been manipulated than any kind of, truth about who should or should not lead.
Yeah, I like that. And certainly the image on the wall in the cave, I think that's a great placement of that in this context. It actually reminds me of, it really struck me in Marshall McLuhan's 1962 Gutenberg Galaxy, where he points out that the images that we see on our screens are two-dimensional. So they have length and width, but the depth on the screen is from the perspective of the person who made the image. And so we can look at the image and we can be confused by the depth. If somebody is filmed, for example, from below, they seem taller. If they're filmed closer, it seems as if there's more people filling the screen. So you could make a small demonstration look very large and important by just simply moving the camera angle and getting that difference in depth. And so this is, yeah, if we're prisoners in the cave, watching these social media screens, what's the agenda of the people who are placing that depth perspective there and making us think about, is this really the way time unfolds with this particular depth perspective? It's something that's very concerning. And what you said too about democracies, I guess, yeah, I do think that it's kind of come to a point where we think that democracy means that we can get what we want. And so when I looked at Plato's Republic, this is book eight, his section on imperfect societies, and he's talking about democracy. He says, then in democracy, there's no compulsion either to exercise authority if you are capable of it, or to submit to authority if you don't want to. You needn't fight if there's a war, or you can wage a private war in peacetime if you don't like peace. And if there's any law that debars you from political or judicial office, you will nonetheless take either if they come your way. It's a wonderfully pleasant way of carrying on in the short run, isn't it? He says. And then he goes on. This is then in the section on tyranny, which follows democracy, because he sets out the kind of process that democracy starts with an oligarchy, and the oligarchs get too powerful, and the people take over from the oligarchs. They get the oligarchs out, people take power. And then the power of the people starts to devolve, and when they start to get a taste for material goods and an excess desire for liberty. So at the very beginning of the section on tyranny, this is at Republic 562, 562D or so, 562C. He says, an excessive desire for liberty at the expense of everything else is what undermines democracy and leads to the demand for tyranny. And I wonder if, I just see so many resonances in those words, in that we're getting these strongmen type leaders now, the leaders who say, I know how to fix everything. Leave it to me. I will fix it for you. And that's kind of really what I think he's saying in this, as we start to get this excess of liberty. Everybody wants everything, and nobody's able to agree. So is, I mean, human nature, I guess, is the same as it was 2,400 years ago.
I think it is. Yeah, I think Plato's predictions have borne out. And I also think the predictions of the Enlightenment thinkers who proposed this transition to liberal democracy have not borne out. So in one of my more recent pieces on Plato for the Masses, I talk about James Madison's essay in the Federalist Papers, number 10, where he argues for a liberal democratic system of representatives distributed across a landmass on the basis that this will quell divisions and allow for some kind of approximation of unity. And, here in the United States, we've had more than 200 years experimenting with this, and the fractiousness and the factionalism is not just a recent phenomenon. In fact, we go through this in this country about every 20 to 30 years. We went through this during the late 1960s, early 1970s. We went through this in the 50s with the Red Scare. We went through this during the Great Depression. And of course, most famously, we had a civil war in this country over the issue of slavery. And that was just 70 years after Madison was writing. And so I think there's something to be said for if you have a system that made predictions about how the political system would operate, and those have been shown to not have played out the way they were predicted, and you have another set of predictions, Plato's, that are predicting this tendency for democracies to seek unity through a strong figure. Somebody who can take those swirling passions and subjugate them to a powerful will, then that should make us think, well, have we given Plato's alternative a real opportunity? And one of the things I point out in my piece is that oftentimes when I talk to supporters of contemporary de democratic systems, they'll cite Winston Churchill as saying, yeah, sure, democracy is the worst system except for all the others. Except that's not what he said. He said democracy is the worst system except for all the others that have been tried. And Plato has laid out a roadmap for something that really has not been tried, certainly not at scale. And so it makes me think this is a golden opportunity for us in the 21st century to recognize the urgency of our situation and say, hey, let's refound the ethos of our countries on a system that says the most important thing is not getting what we want. The most important thing is doing what is good. The most important thing is approximating the form of justice. And it is possible to build a society around that different orientation, but it does mean giving up a certain type of freedom, which is, in some ways, the freedom to be petulant, the freedom to be vengeful, the freedom to be obstinate, the freedom to be ignorant. Yes, we will have to give those things up. And I say, good riddance.
Yeah, no, good point. And I think the narrative is going around now where people simply kind of, it's almost like a reaction of a child saying, I do not want to be told what to do. No government will tell me what to do. And a senator actually wrote a letter that I saw yesterday about rules that are being discussed for AI regulation, you know, because there's a lot of problems in AI, of course, and issues like biases and all of this. And his position in this letter was that the only outcome of any attempt to regulate AI would be for the government to be telling people what to think, and therefore we shouldn't do it. And, you know, I guess this kind of narrative of nobody is going to tell me what to do flies in the face of how humans actually exist. I think it was made quite powerfully in the beginning of the Republic, or near the beginning of the Republic, where it said that none of us can live separately and apart from everybody else. We depend on other people. Anybody depends on other, like certainly when we're infants, we depend on our parents and the community. And even now, you know, the wealthiest people, I mean, a wealthy multimillionaire can't probably build his own home. He can't make his own clothes. He can't make the car and the airplanes that he flies in. And he can't, you know, all he needs people for this. But on the one hand, we say, well, we kind of understand that we need people. But then we think that we can do anything that we want, regardless of what it does to those people. And somewhere, how do we get back on track to understand how human
Yeah.
community actually works and the necessity of community?
Well, can I just jump in there? Because I want to really exacerbate something important you're saying, which is the libertarian fantasy that there can be some space where nobody is telling me what to do is not possible. Because whether it's the advertisers or the educators, or the politicians, or the plutocrats, or the military, or the AI bots on Twitter, there is always somebody who is filling your head with how to view the world. We are born into systems of thought. And Plato understood this. And so what he was arguing for is a realism that says there's always going to be somebody filling your head with images and ideas. So let's let it be good, wise, and just people. Now, I think this allows us to touch something that came up earlier and we didn't fully get to address, which is suppose somebody listening to our conversation thus far says, "Oh, you all are a bunch of idealists. This could never work practically." Well, my view is that idealism is the only pragmatics. It's only when you believe in something that transcends the current situation that you can do anything about the current situation. And here's what Plato had to say to put what we've been saying thus far where the rubber meets the road. When it comes to those in power, the people we put in power have to be those who don't want it. And that is a crucial constraint. It's not whoever the people want. No, it's those who get placed in power are those who don't want it. And so he came up with some ideas for how you would disincentivize people to want positions of power, and then the society would compel people to serve on their behalf. And this is where the idea of civil servants, or as Plato called them, servants of the laws, would come from. They're not rulers seizing power, they're people who don't want power being placed in positions of power. And so, in one of my essays, I articulated this idea in the form that it's not a legitimate system for selecting leaders for office, like elections, if there is no constraint on the quality of the people who are selected. So, one of the constraints that I suggested, this is another practical rubber meets the road, is that if somebody has had a net worth of $10 million at any point in the year prior to taking office, they're disqualified. Because for Plato, you can't be rich and good. And so now we could argue over these constraints, but these are ways of taking the ideal and giving them a practical quality that says, no, we're not going to put into power just anybody that the people wants. We're going to put these constraints. They have to be people who don't want power, and they have to be people who meet certain virtue constraints, like they can't be filthy rich. And so that's, I think, the way to sort of recognize there's always going to be somebody in power. There's always going to be somebody outside of you shaping your life. So let's let it be virtuous people and not corrupt plutocrats and politicians.
I think, and I want to get onto the topic of virtue actually, because that was a key subject of the laws. But just to pick up on a few points that you mentioned, not wanting power, of course, the prisoner in the cave in the Republic, when he was taken out and shown the light, what actually made those images, and then he was forced back into the cave to help the cave dwellers to see the light themselves. He was told, he didn't want to do it. He didn't want to do it, but he was told he had to. And he was further told that if he told the people the real truth, they might want to kill him, which is, in a sense, what kind of Machiavelli warned when Machiavelli said that the most dangerous enterprise is to make change, because the people who would support you do so with lukewarm fervor, but the people who would oppose you do it with all of their might. I think, yeah, definitely people who don't need that leadership role, I think that's a key thing, to have people who don't depend on that leadership role, who have other resources to depend on. Like, they don't need to do this as a job. This is not a profession, I guess.
Although Plato, his version of that was to say they become a ward of the state, meaning they're not allowed to accumulate wealth or power for themselves. And I think that's something we should revisit today, which is saying, in my country, when you leave office, you go and publish a book and make millions of dollars off of your memoir about time in office. I think Plato would make that illegal.
And he also, in the laws, of course, said that the wealthiest should be no more than four times wealthier than the poorest. And that selection that I read about the rise of tyranny, I think certainly when there's that great disparity in wealth, that's when people become very restive and upset if they've been excluded, and then they look for some sort of strong person to give them power that they weren't able to achieve on their own in the so-called democratic system. And certainly finding the best people is key. And that's maybe what we don't do. We have this kind of big showy process where we sometimes talk about policies. Rarely are they implemented if the politicians are elected, or the policies are of such a fleeting nature that things change by the time it comes to implementing them. So maybe it's more about finding the right people. So you talked about virtue. So in the laws, the ideal constitution for the colony of Magnesia would be one that was based on virtue, not just virtue for the leaders, but also for the citizens, because the citizens have to be virtuous to be led, because we'll all be led at some point in our life, but also to lead, because some will accede to leadership. So we don't have constitutions now, I don't think. I can't really think of any constitution that really emphasizes virtue, you know, that kind of higher ideal that you talked about at the beginning. You know, it's more constitutions that just talk about how to maintain stable functions, perhaps. And if we were to bring the Athenian stranger, for example, from the laws into the 21st century and show him the constitutions that we have now and say, well, we don't have virtue here. What are we supposed to do? How would we, like, first of all, is there an understanding of the word virtue? I mean, we talk about the four virtues. If you ask a person what virtue is, maybe they would do what Meno did in the dialogue, the Meno, and just throw out a bunch of examples. And Socrates says, no, you're not defining virtue. You're giving me a swarm of virtues. I ask you for what virtue itself is. So if we say, okay, fine, well, we should have virtuous societies. Citizens and leaders should be virtuous alike. And then people are going to say, well, you're not going to tell me how to be virtuous. So what do we do about that? I mean, a lot of people think that they're virtuous now, but maybe they're not.
Well, they're almost certainly not, because virtue is not something you're born with, and virtue is not something you choose. And I think that gets to the heart of our contemporary problem, which is both the result of Enlightenment thought and then the result of postmodern ideas in the last 70 years or so have created this perspective among people that what really matters when it comes to quote unquote being a good person is getting what you want and feeling good. And so Plato has this model of the soul. He divides sort of the person into these three spheres. I usually call them, I think my typology is slightly different than the one you use, but I usually call it the spheres of reason, feeling, and desire. And so Plato was really concerned about political constitutions where desire or feeling is the primary driver of the policies of that country. What should drive it is reason. And I think our problem today is that because Western democracies are built around the values of freedom and rights, those are sort of the two anchor points, or sometimes liberties would be the other word, right? Liberties and rights. That what is a liberty? A liberty is getting what you want. So it's desire satisfaction. What is a right? A right is the ability to demand what you want of somebody else. And when it comes to being a good person, for most people, it's what feels right to me. And Plato's proposal for overcoming a situation like that is to revamp the education system. So, famously, Marxists say the way you change a society is you seize the means of production, right? That's their famous slogan. I've sort of taken to saying that the Platonists version of that is you need to seize the means of education. And you actually can see that most people realize education is a crucial battleground because education policies are constantly being fought over in these Western democracies. And so I think that really proves that Plato was right. And so I think what we need is for a few good, virtuous people to seize the means of education and say, hey, we're going to reorient how the next generation is educated. We're going to educate them towards virtue. And then Plato says in the laws, once that generation has come of age, they will be slotted into the positions of power to then infect virtue into the legal system as a whole.
Yeah, I think certainly the COVID-19 pandemic, when a lot of students had to be out of school or were trying to learn remotely, I think, and what I've been reading, it sort of brought the question of the education system to the fore, when I think a lot of people now understand that there are issues. And certainly in the higher academic settings, I'm seeing a lot of commentaries about how academics are chasing after citations and all of these so-called objective measures, but are they really producing valuable material? Are they really being original? And I think there was it was a few years ago, a study that looked at the originality of research coming out, and it was found to be the originality was decreasing. So certainly revamping education, I think, makes sense. But then, of course, the objection would be, well, you were indoctrinating people. And this is pitched battles are being waged about this now, with books being deemed not fit for students to read and librarians being put in jail or threatened with being put in jail for having books on their shelves. And a certain faction thinks, yes, they know what kids should be taught and what kids shouldn't be taught. And then other factions say, well, we think of a different way. And then how are we ever going to bring those two sides together to say, well, and I want to talk about kids too. And this is maybe a good segue to the children, because we are not doing our responsibility to the children. I want to talk about that. So how would a Platonic character look at today's education system and say, well, maybe what's the first step? Like, we can't maybe revolutionize it in all in one step, but what's the first thing? What is the sort of basic thing that we need to start addressing?
Yeah, good. Let me throw out two first steps and tell me what you think of these. Because we need two, because we need one that's facing the educators and one that's facing the educated, the children,
Yeah,
right?
exactly.
So
Yep.
the step facing the educators, I think, is to realize somebody is going to be indoctrinating the kids. This is, I think the bullet has to be bit. This is the thing I was saying earlier. Young minds will be filled with some ideas or other. If they're not indoctrinated by you, it will be someone else.
And
And
that's what's said in the laws.
so we need to get over this idea again, this libertarian fantasy that I'm going to, purify my mind and only think the thoughts that originated in me. No, that will never happen. And so the question is, to the educators, how will you take up this mantle of responsibility given that somebody is going to indoctrinate them, but you have the opportunity to infect them with good ideas? And so that would lead to the second step, the one that's facing the children then. I think the first step has to be to develop, I'm thinking about how to say this best. Education curricula that goes beyond math and phonics. Now, that's a phrase from the United States here, which is we had this idea that we're going to have value neutral education. We're just going to teach kids math and phonics. We're not going to teach them about religion or about moral systems or about political beliefs. We're going to just be completely neutral on those things. And what Plato says is that's ridiculous. You can't create neutral people. And so you're just abdicating the responsibility to teach the youth how to engage with these ideas. So I think the right first step is from the youngest ages to start teaching them philosophy. Because philosophy is the conversation of all the great ideas. And so you'd immediately be exposing the youth to a diversity of ideas. You'd be exposing them to the great conversations around these ideas. They'd see that it is possible to have civil, respectful, yet substantive and strident conversation on the ideas. And it would, I think, inoculate them against this idea that being wrong is the worst thing possible. That's ridiculous. Alfred North Whitehead, the great Platonist process philosopher of the 20th century, said that error is the source of creativity. By the willingness to take risks and be wrong is how we learn and generate new ideas. And we have so many people in our countries right now who are so afraid of picking the wrong side or of admitting that they made a mistake. And we need to raise up generations who are comfortable with making mistakes. So that would be my first step, is teach philosophy at young ages, and as part of that, show them that it's okay to think different thoughts and to be wrong.
I like it. Yeah, and that two-part approach, dealing with the educators at the same time as the students, and making sure that the sophists don't sort of get into the system and infect the system, the Protagoras and people from Plato's dialogues who go about saying that they know, but they don't know what they don't know. This is the problem.
So,
And
James,
that
can you say more here? What would be a sophist in a modern day context? Because I agree with you. We need to exclude sophists from education. What kinds of people are we trying to exclude?
Well, we agreed we wouldn't name names in this, so I'm thinking of one particular, bills himself as a philosopher and sells a lot of books. He does a big talking circuit and has a big following, but that's somebody who maybe thinks that he knows more than he knows, or maybe he doesn't know what he doesn't know, right? So that's what I would worry about, is that some people like that might get their hands on the levers of education and kind of set a more rigid curriculum. Because I really think what the teacher needs to do is to guide the students in that discussion process, to have the students understand how to conduct their own dialogue. There was a great experiment done some years ago. It was a TED Talk. And this educator, he set up an experiment in a very poor area in an area of one of the big Indian cities, and he put a screen and a keyboard in a niche in a wall, and it had an internet connection, and he just had cameras observing it. So the children would come along, and a lot of them hadn't had any experience with the internet, but some had. So the ones that had taught the ones who didn't have how to use it. And on their own, the children taught each other. And he was so pleased because one girl, actually, I think she was 16, but she learned physics at a university level just from this ability to interact with her peers. And I think that's maybe what the teacher is really good at, to make sure that the kids have the resources they need to conduct their discussion, but kind of facilitate that discussion. And I love the idea of philosophy using that as a means to facilitate the discussion. For example, I mean, I think the dialogue, the Meno, could be taught in schools. It could be taught in elementary schools, for that matter. I have a problem because I think a lot of people read The Republic in high school. I did not. I'm glad I did not, because I wouldn't have understood it. And I think it's been misunderstood. People read The Republic and think that Plato was an absolutist and he wanted people to do what the guardians said that they should do and all of this. But that's a misreading. That's a very shallow reading of people who don't understand it. So I think you can't just throw any philosophy, I guess, at people without facilitating it and
No, I
keeping it.
agree. No, I agree. So let me answer my own question first regarding the sophist. I would characterize the sophist who views education as a process of manipulating the youth for the sophist's benefit. That is, to accumulate power for their faction or their class or their race or their religion or whatever. So good teachers are people who educate for the benefit of the educated, not for their own benefit. And so I think we could come up with some practical criterion on how to differentiate the sophists from the true teachers. And then secondly, to your question of, the worry about what what kind of curriculum is going to get taught, I think we can actually approach this from two directions. One is, so Plato actually has kind of a dual conception of philosophy. One conception of philosophy is just the exchange of ideas in the context of goodwill. So, in that sense, he can have a dialogue with someone like a Protagoras or a Gorgias. because they're still part of this intellectual milieu where we're teaching kids how to run ideas against each other, how to challenge, how to give reasons, how to make arguments. And that can be very inclusive. We can be okay about saying, hey, we're going to allow a lot of ideas here, even ideas that we think are bad ideas, because they're not just being presented without any context. They're going to be in this context of here's how to critique, explore, examine, criticize these ideas. And then, of course, Plato has this more narrow conception of philosophy, which is his own system, his metaphysics, his epistemology, his ethics, his politics. And there, I think that's where the seizing the means of education needs to come into place, is we need people in positions of political authority who have the courage to say, there is no such thing as a values neutral government. And I would like us to teach the values that Plato encouraged as part of our curriculum. That we're going to take a position on certain issues. We're not going to do it by force. We're not going to do it by, you can't get a job if you don't sign the dotted line to the Plato Manifesto. We're not going to do anything coercive like that, but we are going to teach these ideas as if they are the best ideas. And so when it comes to wealth, we're going to teach Plato's values on wealth. So, yes, this isn't an abandonment of the kind of liberal idea that says, oh, the government is neutral and never takes a position on anything. But that's because I don't think any liberal government has ever actually done that. They all have their values tacitly being enforced. Plato says, let's just be upfront about what our values are and let's teach those to the youth.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's empowering because if we hide, if we pretend that you can have a value neutral system, then as you say, people are going to come in there and expound their values and the loudest voices will win. This was the other thing I was thinking too, is that I think children need to learn history. I think, and I've talked about it many times in the past, is that technology, to borrow a term that Alan Jacobs used some years ago, borrowing from a term that Thomas Pynchon introduced in a novel in the 1970s, our temporal bandwidth has been shortened by technology. And so we are not seeing that long tail of cause and effect connections. And we're only looking at a very shorter and shorter terms of time. And so I think if children understood the broad scope of history and these things that happen and the things that motivate people, I think it makes them understand the human condition and that it's one thing to have theories, but then things always turn out different in practice. So how do we build some sort of ideal that we can work towards that isn't going to be corrupted by some powerful idea that comes along with its own self-interest or
Let's be clear here, James. I mean, again, we're idealists, not utopians. And this is something that I think you mentioned some kids reading The Republic in high school and getting the wrong idea about Plato. And that's because poorly informed teachers have presented Plato as this totalitarian utopian. A utopian is somebody who says, we're going to build a perfect society that will never have any problems, and that'll be it. We'll have solved every problem. Plato was not a utopian. The Republic, the Statesman, the Laws, the Gorgias, these were dialogues written for real people with all their flaws in the present moment to build societies that aim at justice. And so we need to recognize that what Plato is encouraging us to do is to take the risk that says justice is worth fighting for. Not freedom, not domination, not subjugation, not exploitation, which are all the things right now that our societies are busy fighting for. But justice is something worth fighting for. And Plato is not presenting a vision where we're going to achieve justice and then it's finished. No, he's presenting a system where justice has a real chance to thrive. And yes, more problems will arise, But then we'll have built systems that can address those problems, and then more problems will rise, and then we'll have built systems that address those, and it may not survive. Humans are so ridiculous that Plato is not here giving the impression that we're going to build something that will for sure last for all time. So, James, you and I cannot sit on this episode and tell people, hey, we've got a solution that guaranteed will last. What we are telling people is, we've got something that will give us a real chance. And yeah, humans might mess it up because that's what we do. But let's give justice a real chance.
Absolutely. And it's important to point out that Plato doesn't define what justice is. He's not telling us what justice is. It's something that we have to find ourselves. And as you say, we need the systems in place to be able to react, because nobody's going to be able to say, this is justice and you will do this for all time because that is just. Plato doesn't do that. That's the whole question of the Republic. What is justice? And there's no answer at the end of it. I mean, there's certainly a lot of clues, but I think, as you say, the key thing is having those systems in place, because things will change and things cannot be foreseen. And technology is so rapidly evolving now that things change so much that one person's conception of how things should be is very different a year or two down the road, right? So I think that's the key. And certainly, what you said about idealism, yeah, Plato, I think he actually explicitly acknowledges that societies that think that they're ideal, and I think Atlantis really was this case. So both in the Timaeus and in the Critias, it was said that Atlantis was founded by the gods, and this beautiful city, incredible wealth, and very peaceful and technologically advanced and everything. And then he says materialism set in, and materialism set the Atlanteans against each other. And so the seeds of their own destruction were sown from within. And I think we see this historically. I think a lot of people would say this happened in the Roman Empire, for example, that the wealthy became so outrageously wealthy and the rest of the people just simply had no chance to thrive. And this, I think, is what he's saying in that part that I read from the Republic about how tyrannies start. It's just when people feel that they have no hope. And I guess, justice gives people hope, but what is justice? And I think that's what we need to work towards and be careful about. Nobody has the power to tell us what justice, no one person could define what justice is. It's something that we need to find together, I think.
Well, and I want to add something to your excellent invocation of Atlantis. For listeners who don't know, Plato is the inventor of the Atlantis myth, which I think is a really cool part of his legacy. But he's actually depicting there the same corruption that we see in Book 8 of the Republic, because you were right to focus on the latter part of that chapter where we see the devolution from democracy into tyranny. But remember, those steps actually start from the virtuous society that Plato is advocating for. So he is very clear at the beginning of that chapter that you could have the Kallipolis and it could become corrupted. And so we have to be clear-eyed about this. To me, being an idealist does not mean we ever look at our own societies and say, ah, we've built a utopia. No, being an idealist means the opposite. It means the ideal of justice is always going to be something that transcends our present circumstances. We're trying to approximate justice, we're trying to participate in justice. But a true idealist never identifies themselves or their present circumstances with justice, because it always transcends that. It's always something still on the horizon that we're striving for, and that keeps us humble and keeps us oriented towards the good.
Yeah, definitely. And certainly in Platonic cosmology, our sensory apparatus is in the realm of becoming, this constantly changing realm where we don't, sometimes what we see or perceive is not the way things actually are. It's again like that prisoner in the cave. We're looking at these images. Plato calls them representations many times. What we're seeing are representations. We're not seeing the original source, the original template for these things. We're not seeing how things can be changed. And that's where I think understanding, there's a lot of psychology actually in Plato's works. I think he demonstrates a very good understanding of how human psychology works. And I think that's what we need to understand, both in our education, in our leadership, in our constitutions. And I think informing ourselves about history and looking at these ex historical examples and say, we've been here before. What went wrong? What can we do differently this time? I
Yeah,
think we don't do that.
can I ask you a question now? Because
Yeah.
I really love your invocation of the importance of history in the curriculum. So I said the first step is we need to teach philosophy. I think the second step might be we need to teach history starting from the earliest ages. And I think what you're saying is something like teach history with a philosophical eye. That is, don't just teach, one damn thing happened after another. And don't teach the victor's history either.
Yeah.
But teach the history the way people like Plato used it as exemplars to learn from for how to be better people today. So I wanted to ask you, I sort of am a product of a period of education where the big emphasis was STEM, science, technology, engineering and mathematics. And what I have seen has been a complete decimating of the humanities as a result of that, where the humanities comprise religious studies, literature, philosophy, and history and the arts, right? So I would ask, I sort of wanted to know, do you have a position on the impact of STEM in the way that we think about education? And would you advocate for a sort of shift in focus to a more humanities-centric education rather than an engineering-centric education?
Yeah, and I think that this is what in the Republic they talked about is one has to have this knowledge of humanities as well as, a philosopher needed to know mathematics and geometry, but also history and the origin of words and, all of these things that are important. And I think the STEM focus is really driven by the kind of materialist world that we live in. And we think that by giving children STEM educations, that that's where the value is in technology, the value is in science. They will get jobs as a result of having STEM education. They'll be able to service the industries that are building products using STEM. So I understand the economic motive of that. But as you say, I think there's really a growing misunderstanding of how we got to where we are now. And, for me, time is the sequence of cause and effect. We can see where we are now, but not knowing how we got here, I think could be very devastating. And I heard a statistic actually a few years ago. I think in the entire United States in post-secondary education, I think there were only 50,000 students studying history in the entire US. This was a few years ago. And I say this, I actually studied history as that was my major in university before I became an accountant. So it wasn't as if I wasted my time. It gave me, I think, an ability to understand context and to be able to express myself too. I think that's the other important thing that maybe is being lost in STEM is the ability of expression, because there is actually some studies now showing how technology is leading to a significant reduction in the diversity of language. And, memes propagating throughout and people using these memes in their speeches as opposed to coming up with their own means of expression. So I think it's very important to teach the humanities. So I went through public school in the 1970s, and it wasn't that long after World War II. So I remember in school, we learned a lot about World War II. We would watch the film reels and understand the politics. So that really gave me a sense of how humans can be and how things came to that point. At the same time, living in a relatively small and unimportant country in the world, Canada, as I do, we had to learn the geography of the US. We had to learn all 50 US states. And for some reason, we also learned the states of Australia. But it kind of just takes us out of our current circumstances and puts us into different, like, there's a whole world out there. And I think kids need to be exposed to that. I talk a lot about bad things about technology, but a really good thing about technology, I think, is the online learning ability. I mean, I did not have this when I was going through school. I mean, the internet only really came into being really in the early 2000s when people could start to afford it. So when I went to school, if you wanted to find out a fact, you had to go find an encyclopedia or make phone calls, or it was a tough thing. Now you can have a world of information. There's lots of great people on YouTube and really good quality educators, but there's a lot of bad people too. And it's being able to give kids the ability to discern between the good and the bad. And that's where I think teachers can help to facilitate that. But yeah, I think understanding human psychology and being able to communicate with each other is a key thing. And I'm not sure that the kids are getting that now.
I kind of want to use a little bit of your story just to highlight a kind of idea I've been playing around with, a kind of platonic reimagining of education today, which is I think we made a serious mistake when universities took over the role of being trade schools. And so it sort of forced students into this either or. Either you can be a humanist and get a traditional liberal arts education, or you can learn a skill to get a job. And, the result has been that for a lot of employers, if you don't have the degree, they won't hire you. And that has really divorced employers from the responsibility of training their workforce. In the older days, you'd have apprenticeships and so forth. And so I sort of thought what I would like to see us do is have secondary education be dedicated towards building virtuous citizens, people who are skilled in being responsible members of a society, serving their neighbor, serving their country. You could have conscripted public service where you join the Peace Corps, serve in the military for a time period, something like that. And then after university, when you go to work for an employer, they train you in-house rather than this whole system of we're going to, well, I don't know how it is in Canada, but in the United States, we like to put our next generation in massive amounts of debt and then give them a job. And rather than that, I mean, basically, that's free job training for the employers who have all the money. No, I would make the employers train their workforce. That way, they have an investment in the retention of the people that they're training. And that way we separate getting a job from becoming a virtuous citizen. And that frees up people to have more of a journey like yours, where they can be a history major in university and then go be an accountant, which I think is a wonderful trajectory.
And it's true, actually. I was hired, trying to remember now, I was hired in 1989, I guess. And it was the first time that it was a major accounting firm, and it was the first time in over 25 years that they hired art students. And they did it in the year that I graduated as an experiment, because they used to do it in the 1970s, apparently. And then they would train these art students how to be accountants. And to me, that was a much better way than just spending 4 years in university training to be an accountant and then doing that as your job. I mean, I didn't suffer from that. I trained, I think, better as a result of having a different grounding in education. So it's definitely key. And I think, too, that the way university is kind of almost becoming mandatory now to have that university degree, everybody has to have it. And it's really diluting the value. And, I see that too. I taught university courses for 10 years. And by the end of my 10-year tenure, 10% of the course grade was given for just attending class. So you would show up and the students would show up and sign the attendance list and automatically 10%. Well, that's not doing them any favors. It's not doing them any favors because they graduate thinking that they have that 10% knowledge. Well, they don't actually. They just got it for showing up. And I saw that as an employer in the types of students that would come to me. But I really think we would be doing students a much better service if we task them with a bit more thinking in university and less of that, as you say, job training sort of aspect of it. I think if done properly, if done in a way that could really instill curiosity in the students, that they would really benefit from it greatly and probably enjoy the experience a lot more than they do now. Right now, I think it's really chasing after marks because they need the marks to get a good job. And what do they really take out of this whole process? It becomes more of a process rather than a character building exercise, I think, which is really what you want. When young minds are impressionable, as you say, anybody, they're already being impressed by, or impressions are being put on them by other people. So we want the right impressions to be put on them. And I think it's that ability to explore things on their own, empowering them to explore things with their own thoughts, that I don't think we're doing. I think we're just kind of guiding them in a very narrow way, and they're not really left free to explore their own thoughts. And so they aren't empowered.
So just to kind of lead our conversation full circle here, we started by talking about the orientation of our constitutions in the world today, and we've been, I think, sort of bandying about ideas of how to bring the focus on virtue, which is virtue is the means to goodness and justice, how to bring that back to being a centerpiece of our political life. I think that if we're going to preserve a social change like this, if we're going to ensure that it's not just an experiment that fizzles out as the plutocrats, swoop in and tamp it down, I think we really need to appreciate the importance of having exemplars of virtue. So Linda Zagzebski, who is a virtue theorist that I've learned a lot from, she has a theory that's not my own preferred account of virtue, but I think it's a nice amendment to an account of virtue where she says it's really important to have people that you can hold up as models of what virtue means. So you don't start with definitions, although I do want to add here that we have more than 2,000 years of essentially a science of virtue to draw on, that goes through Islamic and Christian thinkers on virtue and goes all the way to the modern time period. And there's really been a revival of the study of virtue in recent years, which has been really great. So there is knowledge of virtue that we could draw on. But I think before we even do that, what we really need is to tie a reimagining of our constitutions to exemplars of virtue. And that I think connects to our conversation about the youth is we need people we can hold up to them as inspirational figures of virtue. And you can see this in religious traditions. So Christianity has a whole tradition around saints. They're supposed to be exemplars of Christian virtue. I think we need a similar version of that, of Platonic saints, if you will. And I think this is different. And this is the kind of point I want to stress. I think this is different than virtuous exemplars is different than heroes of your faction. Because too often what is happening in the United States right now, and what has really defined and shaped US politics, is certain people have been sort of seen as heroes of the party or heroes of the movement. And the problem with that is it's a very exclusionary hero that gets placed up. And virtues, as I think of them, are universal. They're the kinds of things that speak to everybody and that allow people from all walks of life to unite around. So they're not going to be tools of factions that, by their nature, divide societies into these poles. So that's what I would say is another step for us, James, is starting to think of who in history are Platonic exemplars of virtue that could be held up for a society to say, hey, we're going to orient ourselves towards being a people whose laws and whose citizens manifest the virtue we saw in these people, these exemplars. And they can be people from our own history, which I think is good. So for me, George Washington is an exemplar, and Dwight Eisenhower. Those are two leaders from American history that I look back to and I say, I really do. Doesn't mean they're perfect, but I see a lot of those Platonic virtues manifest in their character and in their leadership. So that would be an
Mm-hmm.
example, but it doesn't have to be political figures. It could be, servant leaders from the masses that we also think are exemplars of virtue.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of an exemplar that really sticks out in my mind. You know, as you were talking, I, of course, nobody has a definition of what virtue is, but to me, in leadership, I guess the key qualities I would look for in a virtuous leader are a measure of selflessness, somebody who's not driven by self-interest, somebody who admits errors, somebody who's not afraid to admit errors, somebody who's not afraid to say, I don't know, but I will work with people to find out. And I think somebody who unites people, not divides people. I think to me, those are three characters or three signs of a virtuous leader, which constitutions now just, I don't think, really address that and don't address it among the citizens either. And so I was going to say, I guess if we're coming back to where we started and maybe working towards some conclusion of this conversation, and I want to have more conversations because I think we're really onto something here that I think we want to explore a number of these things. I really am concerned about the world's children and the example that they are looking at. And I have written a piece in the Quantum Record in an editorial that I wrote about free speech absolutism. So, you know, we were talking earlier about liberty and libertarian ideals, and those people say, yes, I should be able to say whatever I want to say. Nobody will censor my thoughts. I will say what I want to say. And, you know, there's a certain maybe that could be tolerated among adults, but only among educated adults who are able to discern truth from, you know, BS. But children is another matter. So a child hearing political leaders call each other four-letter words, or hearing plutocrats spewing all sorts of lies, or legislators spewing lies. Yeah, they have a right to spew lies. Yes, maybe under the current laws, but what is that doing to the children? What is that doing to their sense of virtue? It's normalizing all of this. And I think that's the real problem, is that these things become normalized and we expect leaders to call each other four-letter words now. And then, of course, when that's normalized, then the next step will be even something more extreme, you know, physical violence against each other. And then the whole purpose of discourse in society just gets demolished. So I think in this whole discourse about libertarian ideals and liberty, we are thinking just about ourselves as adults. We are failing to think about the children. And that's what I'm really concerned about, because my life, I might have another 20 years if I'm lucky, but the kids are going to live a lot longer and their kids are going to live a lot longer. And we need to set the stage for them. And I think this is what in Plato's Laws, this great summation of all of his works in this gigantic final dialogue of his, I think that's really what he was driving at with that idea of a constitution that's based on virtue. And so I'm wondering, you know, okay, I mean, we have, I think, a bunch of constitutional messes in a bunch of different countries, my country as well. I don't know. I mean, again, to bring Plato practically into the 21st century, if there's one thing that we could do to instill or put virtue a little bit more on the center stage than it is now constitutionally without tearing ourselves apart in the process, I'm trying to imagine what that is. I'm having difficulty imagining what it is, unless it's maybe something about simply saying that not everybody is qualified to be a leader. I think that's maybe kind of inherent in the Canadian Constitution and the US Constitution as well. I think, you know, whoever the people choose or whoever the people vote for, doesn't matter what their background is, they're entitled to be the leader because that's a democratic system. I don't know. I mean, is that maybe a starting point?
I think it's the most practical starting point for right now is having the courage to say, while it is the case that a leader can come from anywhere, it's not the case that just anybody can be a leader. Plato has this often misunderstood myth early in the Republic about these metals, where he says there are people of different strains in society, and the people who have the leadership strain should become the leaders, the people who have the courage strain should become the guardians, the military, and the people who have the craft strain should become the working class. And the purpose of that story is to actually create a shared narrative among the people that says your children can be of any strain. So if you're a working class family, that doesn't mean you'll have working class children. That you could give birth to a leader or to a military person or whatever. And so there is a really important strain in Plato that we might even call democratic in a different sense, this idea that there are no racial segregations, there are no class segregations, there are no gender segregations when it comes to who can rule. But there is a virtue segregation. And I do think that to be a Platonist today is to have the courage to say that. And there's actually a really elegant way to implement that. That's a growing movement right now in academic conversations, which is around the idea of implementing a lottery, which is to say, maybe what we need is to have less of an emphasis on the highly manipulable masses deciding things, and instead selecting leaders by a lottery, and then having some kind of what Plato calls scrutiny process to assess whether or not the person randomly selected is competent and virtuous for the office. That's something that's being widely studied right now. There's a movement in the United Kingdom right now to get the House of Lords replaced with a House of Citizens. And those citizens would be randomly selected. So there's a big petition going to make this change. So this is actually happening right now. And I think that's the place to start, is to get out of the business of elections, which are corrupted by money and by popularity and by entrenched powers, and to start imagining new ways of selecting leaders, where the emphasis is we want good people, wise people, not just anyone who can win a popularity contest.
Yeah, I think absolutely that the ability to exercise reason is important, and not everybody can exercise reason the same. And I think you touched on Plato is often seen as being an elitist, but I think maybe he's being a realist in the sense that we know that not everybody has the same capacity for reason. Not everybody has the same capacity to assess the way things have gone and all of the options that we can face. And that's not their fault. That's not their fault. And it doesn't mean that they should be shunned. It just means that in terms of leaders, in terms of who we place in charge of not just our adult selves, but the children and their future, the people we put their future in the hands of, I think that's where we have to be responsible. We can't say just not everybody can do it. And that's not their fault. And we value their participation in society, but they're just not meant for that role. Like, it's just the same as I'm not meant to build a house. If I built a house, it would fall down instantly. So don't get me building a house. And the same thing with certain people, they're simply not capable of leadership.
I would be a terrible accountant because math puts me to sleep. So it would be awful for me to try to do your job. But I'm a really good teacher, and that's why I teach. And yes, is Plato an elitist? Yes. But the problem is, we're not being discriminating with some of these terms. Elitism is bad when it's prejudicial. That is, I look down on you because I come from a certain background and you come from a different background. And I just assume, well, of course, people that come from my country are better than people who come from your country. Plato is not remotely an elitist in that sense, but he is an elitist in one very simple sense, that intelligence is superior to stupidity. And virtue is superior to vice, and goodness is superior to evil. And as a result, he thinks that society should be governed by the superior things, because when it's governed by those inferior things, it leads to the great sufferings of society, war, poverty and slavery. And that is what we are seeing in the world today. We have massive wealth inequality. We have perpetual wars all over this world. And we still have slavery. Yes, we abolished a certain form of chattel slavery, or at least we made chattel slavery illegal, although it's still practiced on black markets around the world. But we have allowed other forms of slavery to persist. People who, for example, cannot leave exploitative jobs because their health insurance is tied to their job, that is a form of forced labor. It's not chattel slavery, but it is a form of forced labor. And these are things that are persisting in our world because we're not being elitists and we're not demanding that the superior things govern the inferior things.
Yeah, that's an important point, actually, that was made in again, Book 8 of the Republic, that people get tied to debts. The oligarchs will spread these debts out, encourage consumerism, and people get tied to these debts and they become a slave to their debts. He actually is very specific about that. I think we've touched on so many key things here, and I really do want to pursue some of these ideas in another discussion, if you would. And again, whether we come out with any concrete conclusions, I think we've had some good ideas here, well worth pursuing. And whether there's, I don't think there's any cure that will fix all of the ills of the world, but I think in discussions like this, and I'm hoping others will join in discussions like this as well, I think we've been able actually in this discussion to bring Plato quite practically into the 21st century. He wasn't just some philosopher that wrote 2,500 years ago in very old dusty dialogues that few people bring out, and it's just meant to be studied in philosophy courses for the sake of getting a mark. I think there are some very practical points here that speak to some really current issues. And as I said, when I reread Book 8 of the Republic, that section on imperfect societies, it was almost as if certain sentences were just speaking literally to what's happening today. He was very good on human psychology and understanding the human character. And I think that we need to, whether it's through teaching history or philosophy, or I think those were some really good ideas in terms of teaching, actually. And that's maybe an area that really needs to be pursued. So, yeah, this has been a great discussion. I really appreciate this.
Yeah, if I could say as maybe a closing thought here, you highlighted something that I think would be a nice note to end on, which is you gave some characteristics that you'd like to see in the leaders we select. And one of them you gave, your third one, was the ability to unify. That's one reason why I hold George Washington and Dwight Eisenhower up as exemplars in the history of American presidents, because one, American presidents have not been particularly great. Most of them have been really terrible choices. But what was distinctive about George Washington is in 1789, 1790, when he came into office, the fledgling new republic was very divided. And there was this sort of consensus that he was the only person that they all would accept. And I think we should really think about that. Like, who are the kinds of people who transcend our differences? Same with Dwight Eisenhower. He ran two of the most successful presidential election campaigns in history because people knew that he was a person of great integrity. And one of the things I think most interesting about his biography that is not well known is he was sought for as the presidential candidate by both major parties. The Democrats and the Republicans both asked him to be their candidate, which I is almost unimaginable today. And so they were unifiers. And your comments made me think of something that I want to end with just reading here, which is one of Plato's least read dialogues, which is The Statesman. And The Statesman is really a dialogue about what is the character of a true leader. And his answer is so interesting. It's the person who can weave together the factions of society into a unified fabric. And I'll just read real briefly a little section from 311b in The Statesman where he says this. Then let us say that this marks the completion of the fabric, which is the product of the art of statesmanship. the weaving together with regular intertwining of the dispositions of brave and moderate people, when the expertise belonging to the king, that is the ruler, brings their life together in agreement and friendship and makes it common between them. And I think that is the true ideal of a politics. It's not as the liberal democracies have envisioned, allowing factions to fester. It's to overcome factions to unify people around common ideals. And that's the true rulers. And so I think we should look to dialogues like statesmen to give us a vision of who those rulers should be and what they would look like.
Yeah, that's great. And that weaving motif that plays all through the statesman, as I recall. And it's really, goes back to what I was saying earlier, that we are all part of this fabric of society. Whether we like it or not, we are all threads in this fabric. And no thread can survive on its own. The whole fabric has to work together. If threads start pulling against each other, the fabric tears apart. And I think that's what we're seeing with this polarization. So yeah, that's a really good way to, I think, summarize it. And it's not unifying factionally. It's not saying my faction is unified. It's unifying everybody. It's realizing that everybody has different perspectives. And whether you agree with them or not, you have to find the common ground. I think that's the key thing. And that's why one of the characteristics I said for leaders is that they have to be selfless and they have to admit when they make mistakes. They have to be comfortable saying, I don't know, or I made a mistake. Like the Oracle at Delphi said that Socrates was the wisest person alive because he knew one thing, which is that he knew nothing. So I'd like a leader to come out and say, honestly, folks, I know nothing, but I'm going to work with the best people and I'm going to do my best to apply reason to get us to where we need to be. So we'll see if that person comes along.
Well
So,
said.
Michael, thank you so much for this. This is a great way to kick off season 5 of Plato's Pod and great discussion. And I'm looking forward to hearing what people think about what we've said.
Thank you, James. Me too.
All right, we'll talk soon. Thank you so much.